Ebola. Colonel David Huxall was an expert in biohazards, and this was the sort of situation he thought the Institute was prepared to handle. Within minutes, he had telephoned Major General Philip K. Russell, M.D., who was the commander of the United States Army Medical Research and Development Command, which has authority over USAMRID, and had set up a meeting in Russell's office in another building at Fort Detrick. Huxall and C.J. Peters spent a few moments talking about who else should be brought in. They hit upon Lieutenant Colonel Nancy Jacks, the Institute's chief of pathology. She could identify the signs of Ebola in a monkey. Huxall picked up his phone. "Nancy, it's Dave Huxall. Can you get over to Phil Russell's office right now? It's damned important." It was a dark November evening, and the base was beginning to quiet down for the night. At the moment of sundown that day, there was no sun visible, only a dying of the light behind clouds that flowed off Catoctin Mountain. Jax met Yarling and the two colonels on their way across the parade ground beside the Institute. A detail of marching soldiers stopped before the flagpole. The group of people from the Institute also stopped. From a loudspeaker came a roar of a cannon, and then the bugle music of retreat, cracklish and cheap-sounding in the air, and the soldiers lowered the flag while the officers came to attention and saluted. C.J. Peters felt both embarrassed and oddly moved. Retreat ended, and the soldiers folded up the flag, and the Institute people continued on their way. General Russell's office occupied a corner of a low-slung Second World War barracks that had been recently plastered with stucco in a hopeless effort to make it look new. It had a view of the legs of Fort Detrick's water tower. Consequently, the general never opened his curtains. The visitors sat on a couch and chairs, and the general settled behind his desk. He was a medical doctor who had hunted viruses in Southeast Asia. He was in his late 50s, a tall man with hair thinning on top and gray at the temples, lined cheeks, a long jaw, pale blue eyes that gave him a look of intensity, and a booming, deep voice. C.J. Peters handed the general a folder containing the photographs of the life form in the monkey house. General Russell stared. "Holy shit," he said. He drew a breath. "Man, that's a filovirus. Who the hell took this picture?" He flipped to the next one. "These were done by my microscopist, Tom Geispert," Yarling said. "It could be Ebola. The tests are showing positive for Ebola Zaire." C.J. then gave an overview of the situation, telling the general about the monkeys in Reston, and finishing with these words, "I'd say we have a major pucker factor about the virus in those monkeys." "Well, how certain are you that it's Ebola?" General Russell asked. "I'm wondering if this could be Marburg." Yarling explained why he didn't think it was Marburg. "He'd done his test twice," he said, "and both times the samples were positive to the Mayinga strain of Ebola Zaire. As he spoke to the general, he was very careful to say that that test didn't in itself prove that the virus was Ebola Zaire. It showed only that it was closely related to Ebola Zaire. It might be Ebola, or it might be something else, something new and different." C.J. said, "We have to be very concerned and very puckered if it's of the same ilk as Ebola." "They had to be very puckered," Russell agreed. "We have a national emergency on our hands," he said. "This is an infectious threat of major consequences." He remarked that this type of virus had never been seen before in the United States, and it was right outside Washington. "What the hell are we going to do about it?" he said. Then he asked them if there was any evidence that the virus could travel through the air. That was a crucial question. There was evidence, horrifying but incomplete, that Ebola could travel through the air. Nancy Jacks described the incident in which her two healthy monkeys had died of presumably airborne Ebola in the weeks after the Bloody Glove incident in 1983. There was more evidence, and she described that too. In 1986, Gene Johnson had infected monkeys with Ebola and Marburg by letting them breathe it into their lungs, and she had been the pathologist for that experiment. All of the monkeys exposed to airborne virus had died except for one monkey, which managed to survive Marburg. The virus, therefore, could infect the lungs on contact. Furthermore, the lethal dose was fairly small, as small as 500 infectious virus particles. That many particles of airborne Ebola could easily hatch out of a single cell. A tiny amount of airborne Ebola could nuke a building full of people if it got into the air conditioning system. The stuff could be like plutonium. The stuff could be worse than plutonium because it could replicate. CJ said, "We know it's infectious by air, but we don't know how infectious." Russell turned to Jacks and asked, "Has this been published? Did you publish it?" "No, sir," she said. He glared at her. She could see him thinking, "Well, Jacks, why the hell hasn't it been published?" There were plenty of reasons, but she didn't feel like giving them just now. She believed that Gene Johnson, her collaborator, had difficulty writing papers. And, well, they just hadn't gotten around to publishing it, that was all. It happens. People sometimes just don't get around to publishing papers. Hearing the discussion, Peter Yarling chose not to mention to the general that he might have sniffed just a little bit of it. Anyway, he hadn't sniffed it. He'd only whiffed it. He had kind of like waved his hand over it, just to bring the scent to his nose. He hadn't inhaled it. He hadn't like jammed the flask up into his nostril and snorted it or anything like that. Yet he had a feeling he knew what the general might do if he found out about it. The general would erupt into enough profanity to lift Yarling off his feet and drop him into the slammer. Then there was the additional, frightening possibility that this virus near Washington was not Ebola Zaire, that it was something else. Another hot strain from the rainforest. An unknown emerger. And who could say how it moved or what it could do to humans? General Russell began to think out loud. "We could be in for a hellacious event," he said. "Given that we have an agent with a potential to cause severe human disease, and given that it appears to be uncontrolled in the monkey house, what do we do? We need to do the right thing, and we need to do it fast. How big is this sucker? And are people going to die?" He turned to Colonel C.J. Peters and asked, "So what are our options here?" C.J. had been thinking about this already. There are three ways to stop a virus: vaccines, drugs, and biocontainment. For Ebola, there was only one way to stop it. There was no vaccine for Ebola. There was no drug treatment for Ebola. That left only biocontainment. But how to achieve biocontainment? That was tricky. As far as CJ could see, there were only two options. The first option was to seal off the monkey colony and watch the monkeys die. And also keep a close watch on the people who'd handled the monkeys and possibly put them into quarantine as well. The second option was to go into the building and sterilize the whole place. Kill the monkeys, give them lethal injections, burn their carcasses, and drench the entire building with chemicals and fumes. A major biohazard operation. General Russell listened and said, "So option one is to cut the monkeys off from the rest of the world and let the virus run its course in them. And option two is to wipe them out. There aren't any more options." Everyone agreed that there were no other options. Nancy Jacks was thinking, "It may be in the monkey house now, but it ain't going to stay there very damn long. She had never seen a monkey survive Ebola. And Ebola is a species jumper. All of those monkeys were going to die, and they were going to die in a way that was almost unimaginable. Very few people on Earth had seen Ebola do its work on a primate, but she knew exactly what it could do. She didn't see how the virus could be contained unless the monkey house was set up for quarantine with an independently filtered air supply. She said, "How ethical is it to let these animals go a long time before they die? And how do we assure the safety of people in the meantime? I've watched these guys die of Ebola, and it's not a fun way to go. They're sick, sick, sick animals." She said that she wanted to go into the monkey house to look at the monkeys. "The lesions are easy to miss unless you know what you're looking for," she said. "And then it's as plain as the nose on your face." She also wanted to go there to look at pieces of tissue under a microscope. She wanted to look for crystalloids or inclusion bodies. Bricks. If she could find them in the monkey meat, that would be another confirmation that the monkeys were hot. Meanwhile, there was the larger question of politics. Should the army become involved? The army has a mission, which is to defend the country against military threats. Was this virus a military threat? The sense of the meeting ran like this. Military threat or no, if we're going to stop this agent, we've got to throw everything at it that we've got. That would create a small political problem. Actually, it would create a large political problem. The problem had to do with the Centers for Disease Control in Atlanta, Georgia. The CDC is the federal agency that deals with emerging diseases. It has a mandate from Congress to control human disease. This is the CDC's lawful job. The Army doesn't exactly have a mandate to fight viruses on American soil, yet the Army has the capability and the expertise to do it. Everyone in the room could see that a confrontation might boil up with the CDC if the Army decided to move in on the monkey house. There were people at the CDC who could be jealous of their turf. The Army doesn't have the statutory responsibility to take care of this situation, General Russell pointed out. But the Army has the capability. The CDC doesn't have the capability. We have the muscle, but not the authority. The CDC has the authority, but not the muscle. And there's going to be a pissing contest. In the opinion of General Russell, this was a job for soldiers operating under a chain of command. There would be a need for people trained in biohazard work. They would have to be young, without families, willing to risk their lives. They would have to know each other and be able to work in teams. They had to be ready to die. In fact, the Army had never before organized a major field operation against a hot virus. The whole thing would have to be put together from scratch. Obviously, there were legal questions here. Lawyers were going to have to be consulted. Was this legal? Could the Army simply put together a biohazard SWAT team and move in on the monkey house? General Russell was afraid the Army's lawyers would tell him that it couldn't and shouldn't be done. So he answered the legal doubts with these words. A policy of moving out and doing it, and asking forgiveness afterward, is much better than a policy of asking permission and having it denied. You never ask a lawyer for permission to do something. We're going to do the needful, and the lawyers are going to tell us why it's legal. By this time, the people in the room were shouting and interrupting one another. General Russell, still thinking out loud, boomed, "So the next question is, who the fuck is going to pay for it?" Before anyone had a chance to speak, he answered the question himself. "I'll get the money. I'll beat it out of somebody." More shouting. The general's voice rose above the noise. "This is a big one coming, so let's not screw it up, fellas," he said. Let's write the right game plan and then execute it. In the Army, an important job is called a mission. And a mission is always carried out by a team, and every team has a leader. We have to agree on who's going to be in charge of this operation, the general continued. C.J. Peters has got this action here. He's in charge of the operation. He's the designated team leader. Okay? Everybody agreed on that? Everybody agreed. C.J., what we need is a meeting, the general said. Tomorrow, we're going to have a meeting. We have to call everybody. He looked at the clock on the wall. It was 5:30, rush hour. People were leaving work, and monkeys were dying in Reston, and the virus was on the move. We've got to pull the chain on this whole thing, the general said. We'll have to inform everybody simultaneously, as soon as possible. I want to start with Fred Murphy at the CDC. I don't want him to be sandbagged by this. Frederick A. Murphy was one of the original discoverers of Ebola virus. The wizard with an electron microscope who had first photographed the virus and whose work had hung in art museums. He was an old friend of General Russell's. He was also an important official at the CDC, the director of the National Center for Infectious Diseases. Russell put his hand on the telephone on his desk. He stared around the room. One last time. Are you sure you've got what you think you've got? Because I'm going to make this phone call. If you don't have a filovirus, we'll look like real assholes. Around the room, one by one, they told him they were convinced it was a thread virus. All right, then I'm satisfied we've got it. He dialed Murphy's number in Atlanta. Sorry, Dr. Murphy has gone home for the day. He pulled out his black book and found Murphy's home phone number. He reached Murphy in his kitchen, where he was chatting with his wife. Fred, it's Phil Russell. Great. How about yourself? Fred, we've isolated an Ebola-like agent outside Washington. Yeah. Outside Washington. A grin spread over Russell's face, and he held the phone away from his ear and looked around the room. Evidently, Murphy was having some kind of noisy reaction. Then General Russell said into the receiver, No, Fred, we're not smoking dope. We've got an Ebola-like virus. We've seen it. Yeah, we have pictures. There was a pause, and he put his hand over the mouthpiece and said to the room, He thinks we've got crud in our scope. Murphy wanted to know who took the pictures and who analyzed them. It was a kid who took the pictures, young guy named, what's his name? Geisbert. And we're looking at them right here. Murphy said he would fly up to Fort Detrick tomorrow morning to look at the pictures and review the evidence. He took it extremely seriously. 18:30 hours, Tuesday. Dan Dalgard had to be called, and they had to notify Virginia's state health authorities. I'm not even sure who the state authorities are, Russell said. And we've got to get them on the phone right now. People were leaving work. We'll have to call people at home. It's going to be a bunch of phone calls. What county was that monkey house located in? Fairfax County, Virginia. My, oh my, a nice place to live. Fairfax County. Beautiful neighborhoods, lakes, golf courses, expensive homes, good schools, and Ebola. We'll have to call the county health department, the general said. They would also have to call the U.S. Department of Agriculture, which has control over imported monkeys. They would have to call the Environmental Protection Agency, which has jurisdiction in cases of environmental contamination by an extreme biohazard. General Russell also decided to call an Assistant Secretary of Defense just to get the Pentagon notified. People left the room and fanned out along the hallways, going into empty offices and making the calls. C.J. Peters, now the team leader, went into another office down the hall and called Dan Dalgard's office with Peter Yarling on an extension line. Dalgard had gone home. They called Dalgard's home, and Dalgard's wife told him that Dan hadn't arrived yet. At about 6:30, they called Dalgard's house again, and this time they got him. "This is Colonel C.J. Peters up at USAMRID. I'm the chief of the Disease Assessment Division. How do you do? Anyway, I'm calling to report that the second agent is apparently not Marburg. The second agent is Ebola virus." "What's Ebola?" Dalgard asked. He'd never heard of Ebola. The word had no meaning for him. In his smoothest Texas voice, C.J. Peters said, "It's a rather rare viral disease that has been responsible for human fatalities in outbreaks in Zaire and Sudan within the past 10 or 12 years. Dalgard was starting to feel relieved. "Good thing it isn't Marburg." "What is the nature of Ebola virus?" he asked. C.J. described the virus in vague terms. "It's related to Marburg. It's transmitted the same way, through contact with infected tissue and blood, and the signs and symptoms are much the same." "How bad is it?" "The case fatality rate is 50 to 90%. Dalgard understood exactly what that meant. The virus was much worse than Marburg. C.J. continued, "With the information we have, we are going to notify state and national public health officials." Dalgard spoke carefully. Would you please wait until 7 p.m. to allow me to apprise my corporate headquarters of recent developments?" C.J. agreed to wait before pulling the trigger, though in fact General Russell had already called the CDC. Now C.J. had a favor to ask of Dalgard. Would it be all right if he sent someone down to Reston tomorrow to have a look at some samples of dead monkeys? Dalgard resisted. He'd sent a little bit of blood and tissue to the army for diagnosis, and look what was happening. This thing could go way out of control. He sensed that Colonel Peters was not telling him all there was to know about this virus called Ebola. Dalgard feared he could lose control of the situation in a hurry if he let the army get its foot in the door. "Why don't we meet by phone early tomorrow morning and discuss this approach?" Dalgard replied. After the phone call, C.J. Peters found Nancy Jacks and asked her if she would come with him to meet Dalgard the next day and look at some monkey tissue. He assumed Dalgard would give permission. She agreed to go with him. Nancy Jacks walked across the parade ground back to the Institute and found Jerry in his office. He looked up at her with a pained expression on his face. He'd been staring out the window and thinking about his brother. It was dark. There was nothing to see out there except a blank wall. She closed the door. "I've got something for you. This is close hold. This is hush-hush. You're not going to believe this. There's Ebola virus in a monkey colony in Virginia." They drove home, talking about it, traveling north on the road that led to Thurmont along the foot of Catoctin Mountain. "This is killing me. I'll never get away from this bug," she said to him. It seemed clear that they both were going to be involved in the army action. It wasn't clear what kind of an action it would be, but certainly something big was going to go down. She told Jerry that tomorrow she would probably visit the monkey house with C.J., and that she would be looking at monkey tissues for signs of Ebola. Jerry was profoundly surprised. So this was what Nancy's work with Ebola had come to. He was impressed with his wife and bemused by the situation. If he was worried about her, he didn't show it. They turned up a gentle swing of road that ran along the side of the mountain and passed through apple orchards and turned into their driveway. It was 8 o'clock, and Jason was home. Jamie had gone off to her gymnastics practice. The kids were latchkey children now. Jason was doing his homework. He had made himself a microwave dinner of God knows what. Their son was a self-starter, a little bit of a loner, and very self-sufficient. All he needed was food and money, and he ran by himself. The two colonels changed out of their uniforms into sweat clothes, and Nancy put a frozen chunk of her homemade stew into the microwave and thawed it. When the stew was warm, she poured it into a thermos jar. She put the dog and the thermos into the car, and she drove out to get Jamie at her gymnastics practice. The gym was a half-hour's drive from Thurmont. Nancy picked up Jamie and gave her the stew to eat in the car. Jamie was an athletic girl, short, dark-haired, sometimes inclined to worry about things, and she was exhausted from her workout. She ate the stew and fell asleep on the back seat while Nancy drove her home. The Colonel Jackses had a waterbed where they spent a lot of time. Jamie got into her pajamas and curled up on the waterbed next to Nancy and fell asleep again. Nancy and Jerry read books in bed for a while. The bedroom had red wallpaper and a balcony that overlooked the town. They talked about the monkey house, and then Nancy picked up Jamie and carried her into her own bedroom and tucked her into her bed. Around midnight, Nancy fell asleep. Jerry continued to read. He liked to read military history. Some of the most brutal combat in history had occurred in the rolling country around Catoctin Mountain. At the cornfield at Antietam, where every individual stalk of corn had been slashed away by bullets, and where the bodies had lain so thick a person could walk on them from one end of the cornfield to the other. He could look out his bedroom window and imagine the blue and gray armies crawling across the land. That night, he happened to be reading The Killer Angels, a novel by Michael Shara about the Battle of Gettysburg. Then Lee said slowly, "Soldiering has one great trap." Longstreet turned to see his face. Lee was riding slowly ahead without expression. He spoke in that same slow voice. "To be a good soldier, you must love the army. But to be a good officer, you must be willing to order the death of the thing you love. That is a very hard thing to do. No other profession requires it. That is one reason why there are so few very good officers, although there are many good men." He switched out the light, but he couldn't sleep. He rolled over, and the waterbed gurgled. Every time he closed his eyes, he thought about his brother, John, and he saw in his mind's eye an office splattered with blood. Eventually, it was 2 o'clock in the morning, and he was still awake, thinking to himself, "I'm just laying here in the dark, and nothing's happening." Garbage bags. November 29th, Wednesday. Dan Dalgard slept peacefully that night, as he always did. He'd never heard of Ebola virus, but the brief conversation with Colonel C.J. Peters had given him the basic picture. He'd been around monkeys and monkey diseases for a long time, and he wasn't particularly frightened. Many days had passed during which he had been exposed to infected blood, and he certainly hadn't become sick yet. Early in the morning, his telephone rang at home. It was Colonel Peters calling. Again, Peters asked him if he could send some people down to look at specimens of tissue from the monkeys. Dalgard said that would be all right. Peters then repeated his request to see the monkey house. Dalgard turned away the question and wouldn't answer it. He didn't know Peters, and he wasn't going to open any doors to him until he'd met the man and had a chance to size him up. He drove down Leesburg Pike to work, turned through a gate, parked his car, and went into the main building of Hazleton, Washington. His office was a tiny cubicle with a glass wall that looked across the lawn. His door looked back to a secretarial pool, a cramped area where you could hardly move around without bumping into people. There was no privacy in Dalgard's office. It was a fishbowl. He tended to spend a lot of time looking out the window. Today, he behaved with deliberate calm. No one in the office detected any unusual emotion, any fear. He called Bill Volt, the manager of the Monkey House. Volt gave him a shocking piece of news. One of the animal caretakers was very sick, might be dying. During the night, the man had had a heart attack and had been taken to Loudon Hospital, not far away. "There's no further information," Volt said, "and we're still trying to find out what happened. He's in the cardiac care unit and no one can talk to him. The man's name will be given here as Jarvis Purdy. He was one of four workers in the Monkey House, not including Volt." Dalgard was extremely dismayed and couldn't rule out the possibility that the man was breaking with Ebola. A heart attack is usually caused by a blood clot in the heart muscle. Had he thrown a clot that had lodged in his heart? Could Ebola cause you to throw a clot? Was Jarvis Purdy clotting up? Suddenly, Dalgard felt as if he was losing control of the situation. He told Bill Volt that he was to suspend all unnecessary activity in the monkey rooms, as he later recorded in his diary. All operations other than feeding, observation, and cleaning were to be suspended. Anyone entering the rooms was to have full protection, Tyvek suit, respirator, and gloves. Dead animals were to be double-bagged and placed in a refrigerator. He also mentioned to Volt that the news media were almost certainly going to get onto this story. He told Volt that he didn't want any employees to go outside the building wearing their biohazard gear. If pictures of Hazleton workers wearing face masks and white suits wound up on the evening news, it could cause a panic. Dalgard called the hospital and reached Purdy's doctor. The doctor said that Purdy's condition was guarded but stable. Dalgard told the doctor that if any aspect of Purdy's heart attack wasn't typical, he should please call Colonel C.J. Peters at Fort Detrick. He was careful not to mention the word Ebola. Later that morning, C.J. Peters and Nancy Jax headed out from Fort Detrick for Virginia, and Gene Johnson came with them. The officers wore their uniforms, but they drove in civilian cars so as not to attract attention. The traffic moved slowly. It was a clear, cold, windy day. The grass along the road was wet and green, still growing, untouched by frost. They turned off Leesburg Pike at the Hazleton offices. Dalgard met them in the lobby and escorted them to another building, which was a laboratory. There, a pathologist had prepared a set of slides for Nancy to look at. The slides contained slices of liver from monkeys that had died in the Monkey House. She sat down at a microscope, adjusted the eyepieces, and began to explore the terrain. She zoomed around and paused. The terrain was a mess. Something had ravaged these cells. They were blitzed and pockmarked, as if the liver had been carpet-bombed. Then she saw the dark blobs in the cells, the shadows that didn't belong there. They were crystalloids, and they were huge. This was extreme amplification. "Oh, fuck," she said in a low voice. The bricks didn't look like crystals. Ebola bricks come in all kinds of shapes. Horseshoes, blobs, lumps, even rings. Some of the cells consisted of a single brick. A huge mother of a brick that had grown so fat that the whole cell had plumped up. She saw clusters of cells packed with bricks. She saw rotten pockets where all the cells had popped and died, forming a liquefied spot that was packed with wall-to-wall bricks. While she looked at the slides, C.J. Peters and Gene Johnson took Dan Dalgard aside and questioned him closely about the use of needles at the Monkey House. The Ebola virus had spread in Zaire through dirty needles. Had the company been giving monkeys shots with dirty needles? Dalgard wasn't sure. The company had an official policy of always using clean needles. "Our policy is to change needles after every injection," he said. "Whether it's done religiously is anybody's guess." Nancy collected some pieces of sterilized liver and spleen that were embedded in wax blocks, and she put the blocks in a styrofoam cup to take back to Fort Detrick for analysis. These samples were exceedingly valuable to her and to the Army. What would be even more valuable would be a sample containing live virus. C.J. Peters asked Dalgard again if they could all go see the monkey house. "Well, let's not go there now," Dalgard replied. He made it clear to the officers that the building was private property. "What about some samples of monkey? Can we get some samples?" they asked. "Sure," Dalgard said. He told them to drive out Leesburg Pike in the direction of the monkey house. There was an Amoco gas station on the pike, he said, and the colonels were to park their cars there and wait. "A guy is going to come and meet you. He'll bring some samples with him, and he can answer your questions," he said. "The samples ought to be wrapped in plastic and put in boxes for safety," CJ said to Dalgard. "I want you to do that." Dalgard agreed to wrap the samples in plastic. Then CJ, Nancy, and Jean drove out to the gas station, where they parked in a cul-de-sac by the highway near some pay telephones. By now it was early afternoon, and they were hungry. They'd missed lunch. Nancy went into the gas station and bought Diet Cokes for everyone, and a pack of cheddar cheese crackers for herself, and she bought CJ some peanut butter crackers. The Army people sat in their two cars, eating junk food, feeling cold, and hoping that someone would show up soon with samples of monkey. C.J. Peters observed the comings and goings at the gas station. It gave him a sense of life and time passing, and he enjoyed the pleasant normality of the scene. Truckers stopped for diesel and cokes, and business people stopped for cigarettes. He noticed an attractive woman park her car and go over to one of the pay telephones, where she spoke at length to someone. He whiled away the time imagining that she was a housewife talking to a boyfriend. What would these people think if they knew what had invaded their town? He'd begun to think that the Army might have to act decisively to put out this fire. He'd been in Bolivia when a hot agent called Machupo had broken out, and he'd seen a young woman die, covered with blood. North America had not yet seen an emergence of an agent that turned people into bleeders. North America wasn't ready for that, not yet. But the possibilities for a huge break of Ebola around Washington were impressive when you thought about it. He wondered about AIDS. What would have happened if someone had noticed AIDS when it first began to spread? It had appeared without warning, secretly, and by the time we noticed it, it was too late. If only we'd had the right kind of research station in Central Africa during the 1970s, we might have seen it hatching from the forest. If only we had seen it coming, we might have been able to stop it, or at least slow it down. We might have been able to save at least 100 million lives, at least. Because the AIDS virus's penetration of the human species was still in its early stages, and the penetration was happening inexorably. People didn't realize that the AIDS thing had only just begun. No one could predict how many people were going to die of AIDS, but he believed that the death toll in the end could hit hundreds of millions, and that possibility hadn't sunk in with the general public. On the other hand, suppose AIDS had been noticed. Any realistic review of the AIDS virus, when it was first appearing in Africa, would probably have led experts and government officials to conclude that the virus was of little significance for human health, and that scarce research funds shouldn't be allocated to it. After all, it was just a virus that infected a handful of Africans, and all it did was suppress their immune systems. So what? and then the agent had gone on a tremendous amplification all over the planet, and it was still expanding its burn with no end in sight. We didn't really know what Ebola virus could do. We didn't know if the agent in the monkey house was in fact Ebola Zaire, or if it was something else, some new strain of Ebola. An agent that could travel in a cough? Probably not, but who could tell? The more he thought about it, the more he wondered. Who is going to take out those monkeys? Because someone is going to have to go in there and take them out. We can't just walk away from that building and let it self-destruct. This is a human lethal virus. Who is going to sack the monkeys? The guys who work for the company? He'd begun to wonder whether the army should move in with a military biohazard SWAT team. His own term for this type of action was nuke. To nuke a place means to sterilize it, to render it lifeless. If the hosts are people, you evacuate them and put them in the slammer. If the hosts are animals, you kill them and incinerate the carcasses. Then you drench the place with chemicals and fumes. He wondered if the army would have to nuke the monkey house. Gene Johnson sat in the passenger seat next to C.J. Peters. His mind was somewhere else. His mind was in Africa. He was thinking about Katoum Cave. Gene was very worried about this situation, not to say shit scared. He thought to himself, I don't know how we're going to get out of this one without people dying. His worry was growing all the time, every minute. The U.S. military, he thought, is stepping into a crisis that's already full-blown, and if something goes wrong and people die, the military will be blamed. Suddenly he turned to CJ and spoke his mind. He said, It looks inevitable that we're going to have to take out all the monkeys. A level 4 outbreak is not a game. I want to warn you about just how detailed and major an effort this is going to be. It's going to be very complex. It's going to take some time, and we have to be very fucking careful to do it right. If we're going to do it right, the gist of what I'm saying, CJ, is that we cannot have amateurs in key positions. We need to have experienced people who know what they're doing. Do you understand what's going to happen if something goes wrong? And he was thinking, Peters, Peters, he's never been in an outbreak this complicated. None of us has. The only thing like it was Katoum Cave. And Peters wasn't there. C.J. Peters listened to Gene Johnson in silence and didn't reply. He felt that it was sort of irritating to get this kind of advice from Gene when he's telling you the obvious, telling you what you already know. C.J. Peters and Gene Johnson had a stressful, complicated relationship. They'd journeyed together in a truck expedition across Central Africa, looking for Ebola virus, and a lot of tension had built up between the two men by the end of the trip. The traveling had been brutal, as hard as any on Earth. Roads didn't exist, bridges were gone, the maps must have been drawn by a blind monk, the people spoke languages not even the native translators could understand, and the expedition hadn't been able to find enough food and water. Worst of all, they ran into difficulty finding human cases of Ebola. They weren't able to discover the virus in a natural host or in people. It was during that trip, perhaps as a result of the chronic food shortage, that CJ had taken to eating termites, the ones that swarmed out of their nests. They had wings. Gene, who was more fastidious than CJ, hadn't been quite so eager to try them. Popping termites in his mouth, CJ would make remarks like, They have this extra... and he would smack his lips, smack, smack. And you'd hear a mouthful of termites crunching between his teeth, and he'd spit out the wings, pa, pta. The African members of the expedition, who liked termites, had pushed Gene to try them too. And finally, he did. He placed a handful of them in his mouth, and was surprised to find that they tasted like walnuts. CJ had spoken longingly of finding the African termite queen, the glistening white sack that was half a foot long and as thick as a bratwurst, bursting with eggs and creamy insect fat. The queen you ate alive and whole, and she was said to twitch as she went down your throat. Although snacking on termites had amused them, they had argued with each other about how to do the science, how to search for the virus. In Africa, Jean had felt that CJ was trying to run the show, and it irritated Jean to no end. Suddenly, a blue, windowless, unmarked van turned off the road and pulled through the gas station and parked next to them. The van parked in such a way that no one on the road or at the gas station could see what went on between the two vehicles. A man swung heavily out of the driver's seat. It was Bill Volt. He walked over to the army people, and they got out of their cars. "I've got him right back here," he said, and he threw open the side door of the van. They saw seven black plastic garbage bags sitting on the floor of the van. They could see the outlines of limbs and heads in the bags. CJ said to himself, "What is this?" Nancy gritted her teeth and silently pulled in a breath. She could see how the bags bulged in places, as if liquid had pooled inside them. She hoped it wasn't blood. "What on earth is all of that?" she exclaimed. "They died last night," Volt said. "They're in double bags." Nancy was getting a nasty feeling in the pit of her stomach. "Has anybody cut himself fooling around with these monkeys?" she asked. "No," Volt replied. Then Nancy noticed that CJ was looking sideways at her. It was a significant look. The message was, "So who's going to drive the dead monkeys back to Fort Detrick?" Nancy stared back at CJ. He was pushing her, and she knew it. They were both division chiefs at the Institute. He outranked her, but he wasn't her boss. "He can push me just so far, and I can push him right back." "I'm not putting that shit in the trunk of my car, CJ," she said. "As a veterinarian, I have certain responsibilities with regard to the transportation of dead animals, sir. I can't just knowingly ship a dead animal with an infectious disease across state lines." Dead silence. A grin spread over CJ's face. "I agree that it needs to be done," Nancy went on. "You're a doc. You can get away with this." She nodded at his shoulder boards. "This is why you put on those big eagles." They burst into nervous laughter. Time was slipping away while the virus was amplifying inside the monkey house. CJ inspected the bags. It was a relief to see that the monkeys were double-bagged or triple-bagged, and he decided to take them back to Fort Detrick and worry about health laws afterward. His reasoning, as he explained to me later, went like this. If the guy drove them back to the Reston Monkey Facility, I felt there would be a certain added risk to the population just from his driving them around in the van, and there would be a delay in diagnosing them. We felt that if we could quickly get a definite diagnosis of Ebola, it would be in everyone's favor. Surely some smart army lawyers could figure out why the act of carrying Ebola-ridden dead monkeys across state lines in the trunk of a private automobile was so completely legal that there had never even been any question about it. His old red Toyota was not in the best of shape, and he had lost any interest in its resale value. He popped the trunk. It was lined with carpet, and he didn't see any sharp edges anywhere that might puncture a plastic bag. They didn't have rubber gloves, so they would do the lifting barehanded. Nancy, keeping her face well away from the enclosed air of the van, inspected the outsides of the bags for any droplets of blood. "Have the exteriors of the bags been disinfected?" she asked Volt. Volt said he'd washed the outsides of the bags with Clorox bleach. She held her breath, fighting the puke factor, and picked up a bag. The monkey kind of slid around inside it. They piled the bags one by one gently into the Toyota's trunk. Each monkey weighed between 5 and 12 pounds. The total weight came to around 50 pounds of biohazard level 4 liquefying primate. It depressed the rear end of the Toyota. CJ closed the trunk. Nancy was anxious to dissect the monkeys right away. If you left an Ebola monkey inside a plastic bag for a day, you'd end up with a bag of soup. "Follow behind me and watch for drips," CJ joked. Spacewalk. 1400 hours? Wednesday. They arrived at the Institute in mid-afternoon. CJ Peters parked beside a loading dock on the side of the building and found some soldiers to help him carry the garbage bags to a supply airlock that led to the Ebola suite. Nancy went to the office of a member of her staff, a lieutenant colonel named Ron Trotter, and told him to suit up and go in. She would follow. They would be buddies in the hot zone. As she always did before going into level 4, she took off her engagement ring and her wedding band and locked them away in her desk. She and Trotter walked down the hall together, and he went first into the small locker room that led to AA-5, while she waited in the corridor. A light went on, telling her that he had gone on to the next level, and she swiped her security card across a sensor, which opened the door into the locker room. She took off all her clothes, put on a long-sleeved scrub suit, and stood before the door that led inward, blue light falling on her face. Beside the door, there was another security sensor. This one was a numerical keypad. You can't bring your security card with you into the higher levels. A security card would be melted or ruined by chemicals during the decontamination process. Therefore, you memorize your security code. She punched a string of numbers on the keypad, and the building's central computer noticed that Jax, Nancy, was attempting entry. Finding that she was cleared to enter AA-5, the computer unlocked the door and beeped to let her know that she could proceed inward without setting off alarms. She walked through the shower stall into the bathroom, put on white socks, and continued inward, opening a door that led to the level 3 staging area. There she met Lieutenant Colonel Trotter, a stocky, dark-haired man whom Nancy had worked with for many years. They put on their inner gloves and taped their cuffs. Nancy put a pair of hearing protectors over her ears. She had started wearing them a while back, when people had begun to suspect that the roar of air in your suit might be loud enough to damage your hearing. They hauled on their spacesuits and sealed the Ziploc zippers. They edged around each other as they fiddled with their suits. People wearing biohazard spacesuits tend to step around one another like two wrestlers at the beginning of a match, watching the other person's every move, especially watching the hands to make sure they don't hold a sharp object. This cringing becomes instinctive. They closed up their suits and lumbered across the staging area to a large airlock door. This was a supply airlock. It didn't lead into the hot zone. It led to the outside world. They opened it. On the floor of the airlock sat the 7 garbage bags. "Take as many as you can carry," she said to Lieutenant Colonel Trotter. He picked up a few bags, and so did she. They shuffled back across the staging area to the airlock door that led to level 4. She picked up a metal pan containing tools. She was getting warm, and her faceplate fogged up. They opened the airlock door and stepped in together. Nancy took a breath and gathered her thoughts. She imagined that passing through the gray zone door into level 4 was like a spacewalk, except that instead of going into outer space, you went into inner space, which was full of the pressure of life trying to get inside your suit. People went into level 4 areas all the time at the Institute, particularly the civilian animal caretakers. but going into a containment zone to perform a necropsy on an animal that had died of an amplified unknown hot agent was something a little different. This was high-hazard work. Nancy centered herself and brought her breathing under control. She opened the far door and went through to the hot side. Then she reached back inside the airlock and pulled the chain in the chemical shower. That started a decon cycle running in the airlock that would eliminate any hot agents that might have leaked into the airlock as they were going through. They put on their boots and headed down the cinder block hallway, lugging the monkeys. Their air was going stale inside their spacesuits, and they needed to plug in right away. They came to a refrigerator room and put all the bags in the refrigerator except for one. This bag they carried into the necropsy room. Stepping around each other cautiously, they plugged in their air hoses and dry air cleared their faceplates. The air thundered distantly beyond Nancy's hearing protectors. They gloved up, pulling surgical gloves over their spacesuit gloves. She laid her tools and specimen containers at the head of the table, counting them off one by one. Trotter untwisted some ties on the garbage bag and opened it, and the hot zone inside the bag merged with the hot zone of the room. He and Nancy together lifted the monkey out and laid it on the dissection table. She switched on a surgical lamp. Unclouded brown eyes stared at her. The eyes looked normal. They weren't red. The whites were white, and the pupils were clear and black, dark as night. She could see a reflection of the lamp in the pupils. Inside the eyes, behind the eyes, there was nothing. No mind, no existence. The cells had stopped working. Once the cells in a biological machine stop working, it can never be started again. It goes into a cascade of decay, falling toward disorder and randomness, except in the case of viruses. They can turn off and go dead. Then, if they come in contact with a living system, they switch on and multiply. The only thing that lived inside this monkey was the unknown agent, and it was dead for the time being. It was not multiplying or doing anything, since the monkey's cells were dead. But if the agent touched living cells, Nancy's cells, it would come alive and begin to amplify itself. In theory, it could amplify itself around the world in the human species. She took up a scalpel and slit the monkey's abdomen, making a slow and gentle cut, keeping the blade well away from her gloved fingers. The spleen was puffed up and tough, leathery, like a globe of smoked salami. She didn't see any bloody lesions inside this monkey. She had expected that the monkey's interior would be a lake of blood, but no, this monkey looked all right. It hadn't bled into itself. If the animal had died of Ebola, this wasn't a clear case. She opened up the intestine. There was no blood inside it. The gut looked okay. Then she examined the stomach. There she found a ring of bleeding spots at the junction between the stomach and the small intestine. This could be a sign of Ebola, but it wasn't a clear sign. It could also be a sign of simian fever, not Ebola. Therefore, she couldn't confirm the presence of Ebola virus in this animal based on a visual inspection of the internal organs during necropsy. Using a pair of blunt scissors, she clipped wedges out of the liver and pressed them on glass slides. Slides and blood tubes were the only glass objects allowed in a hot zone because of the danger of glass splinters if something broke. All laboratory beakers in the room were made of plastic. She worked slowly, keeping her hands out of the body cavity, away from blood as much as possible, rinsing her gloves again and again in a pan of EnviroChem. She changed her gloves frequently. Trotter glanced at her once in a while. He held the body open for her and clamped blood vessels, handing her tools when she asked for them. They could read each other's lips. "Forceps," she mouthed silently, pointing to it. He nodded and handed her a forceps. They didn't talk. She was alone with the sound of her air. She was beginning to think that this monkey didn't have Ebola virus. In biology, nothing is clear. Everything is too complicated. Everything is a mess. And just when you think you understand something, you peel off a layer and find deeper complications beneath. Nature is anything but simple. This emerging virus was like a bat crossing the sky.